we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, December the 11th. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our guest co-hosts, Farah Nazarali.
Hello.
And Denise Swanson.
Hello.
After many months off. Thanks for coming back, Denise. And Carmen Pierce is here again today.
Hello.
Jackie and Elise are away today. Welcome, everyone. We have an excellent show today that I'm excited about. First up, we'll be speaking with Jane Land, who is the co-founder of a fantastic campaign that's only in its third year and is growing hugely and exponentially across the globe every year. It's a web-based campaign called Veganuary, which encourages people to try going vegan for the month of January and gives them all kinds of online support throughout. I had the opportunity to meet Jane in person two summers ago when she was in LA and was just getting this program started, and it was lovely to catch up with her this week and learn about the growth and success of this grassroots project, which is run by only three people and yet having so much impact all over the world to reduce the suffering of animals. Then for our feature interview, I was lucky to speak with Tracy Stewart this week. If her name sounds familiar to you, it may be because she's the wife of the well-known television talk show host, John Stewart. They live in New Jersey on a farm with rescued animals, and Tracy has been deeply attuned to animals her whole life. I was able to learn much about this by reading her brand new book, which is called Do Unto Animals, A Friendly Guide to How Animals Live and How We Can Make Their Lives Better. It's a gorgeous book that is just packed full of information, tips, advice, activities, and illustrations on how we can come to understand animals better in our own lives and how we can live among them peacefully and respectfully. She has written the book from her own life perspectives in sharing the ways in which she conducts her life with her family with regards to animals. I highly recommend exploring this book, which is also great for sharing with children, and it's very visual as well. We'll have Tracy on the show later on, and that interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned. So yesterday, December the 10th, was International Human Rights Day, which we spoke a bit about on the show last week, but I wanted to touch upon again how and why it's important to extend and open our compassion towards all living creatures, whether it be non-human animals or human animals. And Farah, you are just doing that with an act of compassion that you've been organizing for this week. Please tell us about that.
Yes, it's called Satya, a spirit and fundraiser, and we called it Satya because Satya means truth in Sanskrit, and we felt it's an act of truth to come together in solidarity and to acknowledge the suffering, and in particular the victims of and refugees of violence and terror worldwide, and to gather together in our hearts and in our voices and in our spirits, and to collectively intend peace and harmony. And so it will be an afternoon of music, singing, chanting, and we'll be collecting money for the Child Refugee Fund of Save the Children Canada. And, you know, I think at the event, it will also be an opportunity to recognize that there is suffering not only in the human realm, but also in the animal realm, and that it is important to extend our compassion to all beings and to intend harmony and peace and happiness for all beings. So that's happening on Saturday, December 12th, which is this Saturday from 2 to 4 at the Open Door Studio on Main and 14th Street. It's by donation, and 100% of the proceeds will go to the Child Refugee Fund of Save the Children Canada.
Farah, I just want to thank you for doing this. And when I was thinking of things that we could chat about today, and I came across your email about this, I thought, you know, this is just perfect. We are kind of talking about these issues last week, right, for International Human Rights Day, which actually it was yesterday, December the 10th. And I think it's just important to implore to people that we're all part of this web of life, right? Like we're all animals. And I think that Satya, like, that just encompasses that so perfectly.
Absolutely. And you know, the most important thing is that we as individuals have the ability to create and intend harmony, and that has an impact all around us, on every being all around us. So it's really powerful, you know, just like they've been having the chicken vigils. It is very powerful to come together and raise awareness and open people's eyes to suffering, and also at the same time intend harmony and intend the opposite of what we see, to create the opposite of what we see in the world, and that is to be together in a spirit of love and harmony.
Yeah, we were mentioning earlier about how sometimes people just don't, they want to close their eyes to the cruelties in this world. It's really difficult for people to connect with harm and suffering, especially when I think it's hard enough when it's, say, it's refugees out in across the world who are in little boats, and they just can't identify with that. But even more so when it's animals, different species.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's why people don't want to watch movies that open their eyes to that and don't want to watch exposés. Absolutely.
Yeah, but when they do, they're often changed people. So moving on, Denise and I are excited about this. We both got Dr. Greger's new book this week called How Not to Die. And Denise has read more than I have. So tell us about it so far, Denise.
Well, this is quite the tome. It's 562 pages.
Oh, wow.
Don't let that scare you off. It's highly readable and very enjoyable. This is written by Dr. Michael Greger, who is the founder of nutritionfacts.org, which is full of dozens and dozens, in fact, hundreds of little health-related videos that are quite enjoyable to watch. And he's written a book called How Not to Die, subtitled Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reverse Disease. In the preface, he speaks of how he got into medicine in the first place. The book is dedicated to my grandma, Frances Greger. She had end-stage heart disease and so many bypasses that the doctors had run out of plumbing, so to speak, due to the scarring from each open heart surgery at the age of 65. She was sent home in a wheelchair to die. However, she discovered the Nathan Pritikin plant-based diet and exercise program, crossed the country to join that program, and within 3 weeks, she was not only walking 10 miles a day, and she lived another 31 years to be 96.
Wow.
Yes, and the book is divided into two parts. The first part has 15 chapters, each of them on one of the top 15 causes of premature death. And the second part is called Dr. Greger's Daily Dozen. And it's about all of the plant-based foods that will help you to live longer. He mentions in the introduction also that our diet is the number one cause of premature death and the number one cause of disability. So this is something within our reach to live much healthier, longer lives if we choose to.
Well, thanks for that, Denise. I'm looking forward to hopefully taking that huge book home on the airplane for the holidays and starting it myself. I want to have Dr. Greger on the show in the new year, so hopefully that's something that I'll be able to achieve. If I do get to finishing that book, I bet you'll finish it before I do, though.
Oh, but, I don't know.
Yeah,
we'll
but
see.
I am looking forward to it. Thanks for that little review.
Sure.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food. Sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food. Hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Vancouver Meatless Meetup is having its holiday potluck this Saturday, that's tomorrow, December 12th, from 5:30 to 8:30 at the Oak Ridge Adventist Church. The address is 5350 Bailey Street, which is at 37th Avenue between Heather and Willow, which are between Cambie and Oak Streets, Vancouver.
This is going to be great fun.
Yes.
And you're just saying that because you just decided to go.
Yes, and I saw the pictures.
Well, there are over 100 going, as far as I see on the website, so there should be lots to eat and lots of great ideas about what you can make for your holiday feasts. It's a fundraiser for the Greater Vancouver Food Bank, so bring a non-perishable food item as your entrance fee for the potluck. You don't have to be following or even aspiring to follow a vegan diet to attend, but please bring a vegan dish to share. That's no dairy, eggs, honey, gelatin, whey, casein, or other animal products. Also, please bring, and that should be 8 servings. And also, please bring a plate, cup, and cutlery for yourself and a serving utensil for your dish. A bag for your dirty dishes would also be useful. If you are not a cook or a baker, or you're pressed for time, no worries. Sharing store-bought food is fine. Please bring an ingredients list for your dish, and please indicate on it if it is also raw and or gluten-free. Again, the address is 5350 Bailey Street. Tomorrow, 5:30. In other events, the Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered is giving away $500 to whomever creates the best, most interesting 30-second video or animation promoting the documentary of the same name, Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, telling the public why it is important for them to watch this whale of a documentary. You can watch the 2-minute trailer at their website, VancouverAquariumUncovered.com. All entries will be aired on YouTube. Please email your finished copy of a 30-second promo clip to them by January 5th. Videos will be posted on YouTube in mid-January, with the winner announced February 1st. To enter the contest or for more information, please email evotioninc@gmail.com. Best of luck to all those of you who want to help make whale captivity at the Vancouver Aquarium history. The orca whale tank was closed in 2001. Now it's time to close the beluga whale and dolphin tanks too. Do we have time for another event?
Yeah, very quickly. Go ahead.
All right. Direct Action Everywhere is having a meetup and musical day of action Sunday, December 27th, 11:45 to 3:30. The address is 186 East 20th at Main. Song, music, and communal singing have played an important role in social justice movements around the world. This month, join us as we sing songs of liberation for all animals. We've done this once before and it was super powerful. The model action plan is we will sing songs of liberation at 3 different places organized as a flash mob. If you want to know where we are going, message us. If you want to be involved in the music group who will be leading this action, please let us know. Lyrics will be on the backs of signs. You do not need to know how to sing to take part in this action. If you have an animal or vegan-friendly event that you would like to have aired on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
For our first interview today, we have Jane Land on the show. Jane is the co-founder of Veganuary. She's an English teacher turned vegan activist and now helps to educate the world about the suffering of animals. Launched in the UK in January 2014, Veganuary is an online campaign that encourages people to try vegan for January. As a nonprofit organization, Veganuary is dedicated to changing public attitudes while providing all the information and practical support required to make the transition to veganism as easily and enjoyable as possible. Veganuary has had an incredible degree of success in a very short time and is changing lives right across the globe. Hello, Jane, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Please tell us how you and your co-founder, Matthew, came to think of this campaign of asking people to go vegan for the month of January, and how did the idea take off in its first year of January 2014?
Okay, so it all probably started with a wine-fueled conversation back in 2013. And Matthew and I are both very passionate animal rights people. So we talked a lot about the best ways that we would help animals. And we'd heard a lot about other sort of pledges out there, like Movember. Have you heard of Movember?
Oh, of course.
Slash,
yeah, very big here in Canada.
And it was, you know, they were really successful. And we thought, well, what could we do similar for that, but for animals? So we thought, right, month for animals to go try vegan. Got to be January with the lifestyle changes and people thinking that they've eaten too much over Christmas and New Year. So a vegan January became Veganuary.
Well, that's a really catchy term. And not only that, but it starts in January when people are thinking about their New Year's resolutions, right?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. So the key message of Veganuary, and I really like this, it seems to be that you're doing it for the animals. On the homepage, it says in big letters, Veganuary aims to reduce the suffering of animals by inspiring and supporting people across the globe to go vegan for the month of January. Can you talk about this focus of the campaign and what it means for you to convey the ethical reasons in this campaign to go vegan?
Sure. The animals for us are always at the forefront of the campaign. It was the reason we founded it in the first place. It's also the reason why the majority of people sign up to try veganism for January. 61%, I think it was, of participants listed that as their reason for trying it. So, yes, you'll see through the site, yes, we've got a lot of information about the animals, animal agriculture and what happens to various different animals and the conditions that they live in. We try to have the health and the environmental reasons in there too, because they are reasons. All the 40% of people that signed up for Veganuary were because of health and environment. So they do feature there, but yeah, for us, it was always about the animals.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the site gives a great overview of the different farmed animals, such as chickens and cows and pigs and fish and rabbits. There are so many resources on this site. I was really impressed by it. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what other kinds of resources you offer the participants on your website and perhaps maybe how this has changed or developed since the first year in 2014, because you probably didn't start off right away with this huge plethora of information on the site.
Absolutely not. I mean, the first year, 2013, is what we called the rush job, when we thought, oh, we've got an idea, let's run with it. And so it was very basic. We had a 31-day menu and some really sort of, yeah, minimal information there about health and nutrition. So at the end of 2014 campaign, we surveyed the participants and said, what do you want from us? You know, what's going to make it easier for you? How are you going to stick with this? And they said that they wanted an eating out guide and they wanted a product directory and better health and nutrition information. So we completely revamped all that, spent the majority of 2015 building the site that exists today, hiring a marketing manager to help us with that as well. So now from 31-day menu, we've got 500 recipes on the site. We have got a very detailed eating out guide and product directory. We've had doctors and health professionals help us write the health and nutrition section. And brand new this year as well, we've got the vegan starter kit. And this collates all the information that people, we think, need when they're getting started. So your shopping lists, your label reading guides, the top myths that people get asked. So we don't want anybody to feel freaked out slightly when people say, well, where you get your protein from, or what would you do if you were stranded on a desert island, and things that might baffle them to start off with in veganism. So we've got all those answered. They're the main resources that we've got on there. We've also got a people section as well, just to show the variety of vegans and to break some of those stereotypes of, you do get healthy, athletic vegans out there, and you do get professional business people, and there are a whole range of vegans.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the recipes section because it's huge. I didn't realize you said 500 recipes. How did you get so many recipes on there? It looks like maybe people are submitting recipes, but then like the very first recipe I saw was by Colleen Patrick Goudreau. It was for coconut bacon. Looks red. How did you acquire all those recipes, which all look amazing?
Just asking people, reaching out to food bloggers primarily, but also the likes of Colleen Patrick Goudreau and other people that we know produce fantastic vegan recipes. And, you know, we've been fortunate that people have been really helpful and generous with them. I mean, we're still asking for submissions, and people get a little author page on there as well. So each recipe is obviously assigned to somebody who's given it to us. So it's a little promotion back to their website as well.
Yeah, so the whole website in itself, I find it's really fun and easy to read. It's really accessible. I think that's great that you've made it like that. I think it'll really encourage people to take part. So speaking of people taking part, how many people have participated in the past 2 years, and how many people do you anticipate to take part this year?
So year one, Matthew and I had a little bet, actually. I said if we have 100 people taking part, that would be fantastic. And he's the optimist in the relationship. And he said, no, we need at least 1,000 people to take part for it to be worthwhile, all our effort. Anyway, we had 3,300 people take part. So we were ecstatic. It surpassed all our expectations, hence why we pumped so much into the following campaign. So it increased fourfold. We had 12,800 people take
part.
Wow. Yeah, in 2015. Looking at that same trajectory, we're predicting we'll get 50,000 people taking part this year.
Wow. So speak of it being worthwhile for your efforts. That's amazing.
Yeah.
If there's one way that, I mean, in your bio here, it says that you now help to educate the world about the suffering of animals. Can you imagine that you're impacting 50,000 people a year and probably more next year? It's just amazing. I'm wondering what you've been doing it just for 2 years now. What have you learned since then? And it seems like you have really taken it upon yourselves to get feedback from the participants. So what have you learned in the last couple of years of putting on this campaign as to how it works for the participants?
Basically, I think what some of the things I've covered is in what they needed and support-wise. So, like I say, we survey them twice a year, once at the end of January and then 6 months later to see how they're getting on still. We were conscious that we didn't want to bombard people too much, overpower them with emails or information, but people said that they actually wanted that. So whereas we were sending maybe a weekly email, we've had people say, no, we want more than that. We want daily emails from you. We want to be part of some community groups and support groups. And we've got all these ideas for the future of what we'd like to offer people. But it's obviously we're still just a team of three. So at the moment, we do have the support group of the Facebook group. So it's / Facebook and a group. And people can join there, and we've got a whole host of experienced vegans on hand ready to answer people's questions. So whether that be, you know, what's people's favourite cheese? Obviously, we've got all this information on the website, but when you want to have a quick chat with people, I know that's really useful as well. Support in the main.
So speaking of getting the feedback from people, I'm wondering what kind of follow-up do you do afterwards? I'm curious to know what their motivations were to take on the challenge, and then if they stay vegan after the month of January, what kind of feedback have you gotten from your participants?
Yeah, so this year, at the end of January, of the survey respondents, we asked them, are you staying vegan? And 51% said that they were, and of the others, the majority said that they were also reducing their consumption of animal products, which was fantastic. We resurveyed them again in June, at the end of June, to see how they're getting on still, and expected the number to drop slightly, but it only dropped to 49% of the respondents saying that they were still vegan after 6 months on. 71% also said that they felt an improvement in their health. So whether that was energy levels, sleeping better, digestion, we asked them all this information, which was great. And 65% said that they discovered something new about animal agriculture that they didn't know about, usually it involves they have no idea about the baby, the male chicks and how they die in the egg industry, and same with the dairy calves as well. Just have no idea.
So this is a global campaign. Do you know what your demographics are? Like, where are people coming from who participate? And then I'm also curious about demographics of what their previous diets might have been, if you have that information.
Yeah, we say it's part of the sign up that we do ask these questions because it's really valuable to us. 79% of people who signed up are vegetarian, followed closely by omnivores, actually. We thought vegetarians might be more, but a lot of the people who take part are omnivores, and then followed by pescatarian. Overwhelmingly, it's women that take part. 87% of participants were women. And we did do some targeted advertising because we know that young women are more likely to go vegan. But saying that, it was still overwhelmingly female signing up to the site. Age range, again, it is the younger generations. 30% of the sign-ups were between the ages of 25 and 34. And it seems to be the English-speaking world. Well, obviously the site, because the site's in English. So the US, we had 115 countries take part, but the US was the main one, followed by the UK and then Australia. But this year we've just translated some of the pages into Spanish, Italian and German. So we're just trying to broaden the reach here.
Yeah. And you mentioned advertising. So I'm curious to know, too, is how are people finding out about this to just be increasing your numbers of participants so exponentially great every year to about 50,000 this year?
I mean, we don't have a lot of money. We are a non-profit, so we're really running on a shoestring. So the most sort of best bang for your buck, if you like, is Facebook advertising for us. 60% of our participants came from Facebook last year. We're growing on Twitter and Instagram as well, but still it's majority of people, it's Facebook that's how they hear about us.
So how do you see the Veganuary campaign to play a role in having people learn about the vegan lifestyle and being able to seamlessly transition into it? It seems to me that people really need the continuous support to develop a habit. And is this your vision for creating Veganuary, to empower and encourage people to give them that needed support?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you've heard that psychologists say that it takes 21 days to break a habit. So we're giving people that and a little bit longer just to try and to secure it. So back to what I was saying before, yeah, it's the support. It's making things accessible and easy. I think, yeah, one of the main barriers for people to go vegan is because it's alien to them. You know, I didn't know any other vegans when I went vegan, and I just thought all the stereotypes that what do you eat and I'll starve. So it's showing people what's available out there, that you can still have cheese and chocolate and ice cream and all those things that people think you're going to have to give up, which you don't, obviously.
Right. So could you walk our listeners through the process of signing up for the campaign? So they go on the website. It's very simple there. They click on sign me up. But then what happens?
So we ask them a few quick questions. We've shortened the process of signing up this year as well, because we want to make it as speedy as for people as possible and not put any barriers away of joining. And then once they've signed up, then we can contact them by email. At the moment it's weekly, but it will get more frequent at the end of December and throughout January, when we send out tips, advice, ongoing support, and give them the chance to communicate with us as well via those means.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Jane, to speak about the Veganuary campaign to encourage people to go vegan for the month of January. To find out all about this campaign and to sign up, visit veganuary.com. You can also find info on our website at animalvoices.org, and I will post the link to the Facebook page on animalvoices.org as well, and on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Thanks so much, Jane, and I wish you luck in this year's campaign, and it seems like it's just getting bigger and better every year, so I'd love to know how it goes next year as well.
Thank you. We'll be in touch.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I'm Farah, and now for some news.
We do have some breaking news, and it's a meow. Feline-friendly entrepreneur Michelle Furbacher is opening the first feline cafe on Monday, December 14th. The location is 88 Pender Street, Suite 2035, second floor of the International Village at Tinseltown. The cafe is divided into two areas, one for the cafe and the other one for the felines to roam freely, where patrons are able to interact freely with the furry friends and adopt if they like. The felines will be coming from the Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue Association and the SPCA. The cafe will act as a center of support and awareness for animal rescue. Each month, the cafe will donate a percentage of the profits to go to various animal charities. One charity will be the Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue Association. The cafe is based on a Japanese concept where people came to commune and brought their cats to the cafe, and they had their Wi-Fi, their coffee, and their books and their snacks.
What a great idea. What a great idea for cat lovers.
I can't wait to go there.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. The first cafe in Canada is in Montreal, and now there's one in Toronto and now Vancouver.
Super.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be great for the cat lovers out
That's
there.
That's for sure. So another piece of news. This one really caught my eye and attention. The headline is, as more Israelis go vegan, their military adjusts its menu. So this is so interesting because I didn't know that Israel has the highest percentage of vegans in their population, which is 5%. And because their military is compulsory, and that means that many vegans find themselves in the military, they're, because of the efforts of one particular vegan who found that when he was serving his term in the military, his nutritional needs were not adequately provided for, wrote a letter, and to his surprise, and to the surprise of many people, I think, the military responded and decided to adjust their menu and not only provide vegan options, but also provide wool-free berets, leather-free boots, and a stipend so that soldiers could supplement their diet. And when I was reading this article, I also found out, which is very interesting, that the Prime Minister of Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, also decided to commit to Meatless Monday, which is really quite remarkable for a prime minister or leader of a country to commit to going meatless for one day a week, which is a positive thing.
Wonderful.
And it's following on the heels of many Israeli institutions that are offering more vegan options. For example, the cafeteria in their parliament recently decided to offer more vegan meals.
And even Domino's in Israel.
That's right, is offering vegan cheese.
Wow. Yeah, I wish they would have that here.
Yeah.
And I know that there are many people who would probably bring up the subject of human rights abuses of the Israeli military or things like that. But, you know, I've been thinking about this. You never know how one action may provoke awareness and open eyes to the interconnectedness of life and to the way that we can live in harmony with all people and live in harmony even in on this limited space, this planet Earth. So you never know whether it's one thing like a Meatless Monday that can maybe open someone's eyes to seeing another person or another human in a different way, or whether it's, you know, some kind of event that opens us up in terms of our human interactions that might open us to the idea that life also exists in animal form.
Yeah, that's certainly a cogent point to be made. Thanks so much for the news, Farah. Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
For our feature interview today, we have Tracy Stewart on the show, who is a passionate animal advocate and a former veterinary technician. Not only is she in the process of currently starting a chapter of Farm Sanctuary with her husband, John Stewart, in New Jersey, but she has also just written a beautiful new book called Do Unto Animals, A Friendly Guide to How Animals Live and How We Can Make Their Lives Better. She is here with us today to tell us about her book.
Hello, Tracy, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison. It's great to be here.
Well, you've written this beautiful book called Do Unto Animals, which shares your ample experiences and knowledge in how to treat animals kindly. You've been very connected to animals all your life, and I'd love you to start by sharing with us your story of how you grew up relating to animals as a child, and now as an adult, how they still emotionally impact your life.
It's funny for me. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia, so there weren't actually a lot of animals around. And I did find, when I was young, my parents actually had a pretty tumultuous relationship. They've worked everything out, and they're happily married now. But at the time, my mom had had three kids back-to-back, and my dad was traveling for work. So there was a lot of tension in the house. And so I did find, we had a little dog, a little peek-a-poo dog, that I used to go to for comfort in my room. But he was about it. That's all that we had. When I got to be about 8 years old, we decided we were going to move to the suburbs and we were going to move out to Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And so once I got there, there was a little bit more around me that I could take solace in. But one thing that happened was there was a farm nearby, and one of the girls that was my neighbor was taking care of horses, and so she would take me every day with her, and I would go there. And, again, this was another escape from what was a pretty raucous house. And so I would go every day, and at the time I didn't realize I was allergic to hay and cats. But I would go and I would roll around in the hay and I would roll around with the kittens, and I would arrive home every day swollen and covered in hives. I'd have to fill the bathroom, the bathtub with ice water and submerge myself. And then the next day I'd be up and ready to go again, because for me, I was living the life. I really loved going to this farm. I do think that as I've gone through life, I have always found that I'm happiest around animals. I'm happiest in those environments, and I really do take comfort in them. And then when I had kids, there was a little bit of time where parenting took over and keeping them alive took over. But then the nice thing that happened was once my kids were a little bit older and ready to go out into the world, I felt like there were great experiences that I could give them as well. And so that's what started to happen, and that's actually how the book started to develop and how the concept for the book came to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I see your book. It's a reflection of how you live your life with your family. It's just a beautiful volume. It's filled with gorgeous illustrations. And yeah, it just encompasses information about animals in our lives. And I think it can well serve as a tool to parents to educate their children about compassion, using many of the ideas incorporated in this book to get them to learn about animals and to respect them. Can you talk to us about your intention for writing this book and why you think that teaching children compassion is profoundly empowering and necessary?
Okay, well, I do actually think that kids actually have compassion. I think kids actually have more compassion than sometimes adults do. And so I think for me, I did start a cafe where I was doing humane education in the back with the kids, and they were young. And I think what I realized then was that they were so compassionate, but that what was ending up happening was that we kind of doled it out of them as the years went by. They would actually see adults that they respected doing things that in their hearts probably they would question, but when they would see an adult do it, they came to the understanding that perhaps that was okay and normal. And so I think that rather than teaching kids compassion, what I would propose is keeping it alive in them and then actually discovering it in ourselves again. I think sometimes as we get older, it can be considered silly to be so concerned with animals' welfare or a love of animals. And so I think as I've gotten older and had kids again and been able to show that part of my life to them, I've realized how not silly it is and how fulfilling it is for me and for them, and has helped me become a better parent.
Yeah, and I just wish that most adults would realize this, and I really feel like we all are born with compassion, but it's just taken away from us the older that we grow, and we become really neutralized and desensitized, which is unfortunate. Well, there are many tips in this book on how we can gently include animals in our lives, and one of them is what you call the hurtless hunt, which I found to be really interesting. What is the hurtless hunt?
Well, the hurtless hunt came about when I was actually researching hunting, and I was trying to understand why people felt drawn to that. And there were several things that I found of what people loved about going hunting. And one of them, the main one that people would cite was being out in nature, slowing down, walking quietly, being able to track an animal. And so then the part that I would hit up against was I wasn't sure where the killing came in to all of that. And so I started to imagine that what if you could convince some people that they could get all of those things, and then rather than ending that experience by taking a life or you know, using a gun, that perhaps we use a camera or a notebook or a sketch pad, and that we still go into the woods and we still pay attention and we still stay quiet and observe. But then when we find who we're looking for, we spend a little time to notice them, respect them. And so that's where the concept of the hurtless hunt came. And, you know, I do that with my kids. We go out all the time. And we just have a lot of quiet moments that are beautiful. So I'm hoping that someone reads the book and maybe realizes that the things that they love most about that experience could still be, still happen for them without taking a life at the end of that experience.
Well, in this book, you also have many practical tips, and you mention that when you're on a hurtless hunt, it's possible that you might find injured animals. I'm wondering if you can speak on that and what advice you have to offer people who might find injured animals when they're out in nature.
Right. Well, there's two things that happen with that. When we found, if we find an injured animal, the thing that I'd love for people to know is that they should take the time in their area and look up who their wildlife rehabilitators are. Because a lot of times people with the best intentions can actually do harm. You know, you could find a bird that is a fledgling that is leaving the nest and starting to fly and think that they've been injured and take them out of the environment where they would be safe. So an important thing to do is to have a list of numbers and to call somebody that actually really knows what they're doing. And so we have that in our house. I also have in my car, a big plastic bin with air holes poked in it, gloves. So I'm always prepared, but I'm never I never think that I know exactly what to do. So I always try to keep myself well-versed in who does know what to do. When we've been on the hurtless hunts and we've found dead animals, the other thing that we do is we decide whether or not we should take the animal for a funeral, or I've also told my kids that if we leave them there, that they are a meal for another wildlife creature. But we've taken a few that we've decided, we were too attached to. And we've had these funerals that end up being beautiful experiences where we really talk about the life of the animal, imagine what they what they saw when they were flying through the air, what they experienced in their lives, where are they now? And I think that is a great way to teach kids about the preciousness of every life. And my kids love it, and I've learned a lot about like what they actually believe and what they've actually heard me say and what has stuck. And we create a playlist, and it ends up being a funny and really uplifting experience. Some might say odd, but we've had a good time with it.
That's beautiful. You've rescued many animals in the past, and I wonder if you can talk to us about fostering, adopting, and the importance of spaying and neutering when it comes to cats and dogs, please.
Yes. Fostering, what's been so nice about that is we have adopted so many animals into our home that we actually do recognize that we have to stop, and that we probably, if we were to continue, we wouldn't be able to give them the individualized care that they need. But we are also very attached to our local shelter, so we hear stories and we know of animals that need a little break from the shelter or a little run in the backyard. And so we have taken in foster animals, and then I've also figured out where to go to get them adopted. My daughter rides horses, and so I find if I take a dog over to the stable where she rides, it's filled with animal lovers. And so I've thankfully accomplished that. I've gotten all our fosters adopted and that they haven't actually become part of our family. But the other thing that's nice about that is you get to really see what it is to have an animal. It's almost like a practice run. So if you choose the right animal from the shelter who maybe needs just a break, because a lot of times what happens is, like with animals in the shelter, shelter, when they're in there for a long time, they start to get increased stress, and they don't show as well when someone comes to see them. And so sometimes it is really nice to just be able to provide them a little bit of a break. The hard part about giving them the break, though, is that once you've given them a taste of the good life, you know, it's hard to bring them back. And so we've actually never ended up doing that. We've always found somebody take them from that. But, you know, it's hard because not everybody gets to the shelter, but if you can get a dog out into the world and have people meet them or a cat and see that they're wonderful, there's more of a chance of getting them adopted. So we do that. And, of course, spay and neuter, I can't say enough about that. You know, there's just so much science behind how that helps with decreasing cancers, certain types of aggression. If we think about that, there is probably, I think it's close to 4 million animals euthanized every year. I think there's the same amount of animals that get adopted from puppy mills. So if we could stop for a moment and start to look at the shelter first before we look elsewhere, we could actually save a lot of lives.
Well, your book has so much content to it, and I wanted to give you a chance now to speak about one of the tips or activities or words of advice that you have in here that is a favorite of yours or perhaps that you would just like to share.
Thank you. There's so much in that book. You should go out and you should buy it. But I do think, you know, I think the thing that I really love about the book is repeatedly through the book, there is this idea that if something doesn't seem right to you, that it probably isn't right. And so as someone who loves animals, I think it's essential that we always question and that we always try to learn more. And so throughout the book, I think there are a lot of stories in there that even someone that is an animal lover, you know, there's things that I learned as I was writing the book that I didn't know about. And then once I knew, I was able to do better. But I do think that what I love in the book is that as you're going along, I think everybody would be hard-pressed to say that they could get through the book and not have learned something that they didn't know that might have been harmful to an animal had they not known it. And so I am most proud about that. And, you know, we just had Thanksgiving dinner, and there were three people at my table who were very smart, very loving people who love animals, and none of them knew that cows don't just naturally produce milk, and they all thought that, you know, it was a relief for us to milk them. So even small things like that, you know, there's litter throughout the book, and I think what I'm most proud about in the book is that it's not going to hit you over the head. I think the book goes slowly and it's gentle, and I think you'll feel a lot more happiness and pleasure as you read the book. And then there are some moments where you have to maybe sit and think for a second and wonder whether there's something you could do differently. But I think I'm most proud of the balance that got struck.
Yeah, it's a great book. I'm so impressed with it. So just recently, you and your husband, John Stewart, announced that you are partnering with Farm Sanctuary, America's leading farm animal protection organization, to open up a fourth shelter location at a farm in New Jersey. This is really exciting news. Can you tell us about this, please, and how it came to be?
Well, you know, it's so funny. In my life, there's that book, The Secret, that everybody always teases me that I have it, and they say that all you have to do is say something, and it seems to happen. And so I had been thinking that, well, you know, I had gone up to Farm Sanctuary to do a lot of research for the last chapter of the book on farm animals, and I had had such a profound experience there. When I started writing the book, I was vegetarian, and then after spending time up there, you know, I was very eager to change a lot of things and change to a vegan diet. But I really started to feel like this was such a profound experience. I wish that this was a more easily accessible experience for a larger population. And so we had bought a farm in New Jersey, and I just kept imagining what if this everything that goes on there could happen there, how many minds could we reach? And so I just started to put it out there to them. And I started taking their animal care conference, which is for people who want to start their own sanctuary, so that they train you to know really just what you're going to hit up against. And then luckily they thought that that was a good idea too, and we've been working on it now, and I think it's going to be incredible. It's going to have a very large educational component, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it too. I've been to all of the farm sanctuaries so far, and my sister asked me yesterday, she's like, can we visit? And I said, well, it's farm sanctuary, I'm sure we'll be able to. So the next time we get there, hopefully next year, I'd love to come see the new farm sanctuary.
We'd love to have you.
Great. You already have some residents at your farm, and I've gotten to know two of them a little bit, Anna and Maybelle, via the videos on your Facebook page called The Daily Squeal. I wonder if you can tell us about Anna and Maybelle's stories and how they came to be at the sanctuary.
Yes. So Anna and Maybelle were believed to be on a transport truck. So they were babies, and they were going to the next leg of their trip was to be a finishing plant where they would have been fattened up and then later transported for slaughter. So it's believed that they escaped, or, you know, that they fell off the truck, and they ended up in the woods, and someone who was an animal lover spotted them. She spent 2 days tracking them through the woods, waiting for them to get hungry enough that she could lure them into her house, and she did. She luckily had a close relationship with Farm Sanctuary. She was able to call them and have Farm Sanctuary come and get them. And then that night that they arrived at Farm Sanctuary, my family was arriving there too. So when we woke up in the morning, we were able to go in with Anna and Maybelle and let them out into, you know, a beautiful pasture after what had been a really traumatic experience for them. And my kids fell in love with them, and we knew that we were opening up the sanctuary and that we wanted to make sure that we had animals that wanted to be seen, wanted to be touched, would be better off for being in an experience where there would be people. And it's funny because Anna and Maybelle initially were so scared and so nervous, and so it took a while for them to warm up to us. Now, by the next time when I had come up, they had been treated so well and with such kindness that they were completely different animals, and they couldn't wait to be played with. They'd run up to the fence if anybody came. They'd drop over to have their bellies rubbed. Mm-hmm. So they're really, you know, they're just perfect for what we're hoping they'll be able to teach people. And now what's happening is people are coming over to the farm and meeting them, and there isn't a person that meets them that doesn't walk away and say, well, now that's done it, you know, that they won't be able to eat pork anymore. And so I realize, like, this is going to change a lot of minds.
Absolutely. And once you've rubbed a pig's belly as well, I don't think you can ever go back to thinking of them.
No, turning back.
Yeah, exactly. So finally, you recently wrote an article for Mooma magazine called When My Veganism Collides with the Holidays. It's the holiday season now, and I wonder if you can tell us about some of the tactics that you employ when inviting guests over for the holidays.
Yes. Well, you know, this holiday in particular was the first holiday that I was spending eating a vegan diet. And so I wrote the article which said that my mantra was going to be love and acceptance, love and acceptance. You know, I had sent out a letter to the people that were coming to my dinner to say that in the last year I'd had some really profound experiences with turkeys and really come to love them. And so I would love to know who was really expecting to have turkey, and if so, how many servings were they going to have? How many would you be eating? I didn't want to order more than I needed to. So I think I was so struck, I was so surprised that everybody wrote back with no problem saying that they were going to be having turkey and how many servings. And, you know, I was sitting at the table with my husband and I started to cry, and I said, you know, I just can't believe after, you know, I know my family loves me, and I know that they've been watching this journey that I'm on, and it's hard for me to believe that for one meal, you know, they couldn't give that up. And so my husband is so much more reasonable than me, and he said, you know, you have to understand that a couple of years ago when you were thinking differently, you were the same compassionate person, you were the same good person, and so are they. And to you, for me, now this is every fiber of my being believes that I'm doing the right thing and I feel good about it. But to the people coming to my Thanksgiving, it's a foreign idea to them right now. What's not a foreign idea to them is the idea that you have turkey on Thanksgiving. And if I'm going to be productive and be at that table with those people and change their minds, then I need to not make them feel defensive and not make them feel attacked. And so I did take that approach this Thanksgiving. And it really was, you know, I put beautiful food on the table that was vegan. I didn't tell people it was vegan until after they told me it was delicious. And then I animal for everybody from Farm Sanctuary. So they all got a new friend that is their charge for the year. And I feel like there were much more open conversations where people were much more receptive to hear me tell the stories, you know, about factory farming. I didn't feel like I was bombarding anyone. I felt like they were actually coming to me and asking me questions. And so in the end, I feel like it was effective. And I think next year our Thanksgiving is going to be a little different. I think, you know, sometimes you just have to have patience with people and remember that, you know, you weren't always in the place that you are right now.
Well, that's a really positive and inspiring story. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Tracy, to speak about your new book, Do Unto Animals, A Friendly Guide to How Animals Live and How We Can Make Their Lives Better. You can find a link to this book on our website, animalvoices.org, and also make sure to check Tracy's Facebook page, The Daily Squeal, for updates on the new farm sanctuary. Thanks so much, Tracy. Have a great day.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our show next Friday, December the 18th. It's going to be our last live show of the year and our annual holiday show. We are going to be offering all kinds of tips and advice for thriving compassionately through the holidays. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. So if you go to animalvoices.org, you can stream shows from our archive or download them as podcasts. You can read our show blog with detailed links. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Just check out Animal Voices Vancouver on iTunes. And stay in touch with us also on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And you can join us also at Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. So I just wanted to put a call out there that we do need help here on the show. Currently, we really are in need of people to produce the show. So if you're interested in learning about how to produce a radio show, no experience required. However, if you do have the aptitude to be well organized and you have the passion and the knowledge about animal rights issues and veganism and you want to do interviews, please do contact us. RadioAnimalVoices@gmail.com is the easiest way. And you can also send us any suggestions and comments about the show there. So we are going to be closing our show now with a song dedicated to Veganuary. Why don't you try going vegan for January? And this is a song by Emily Grove called I Don't Eat Meat Anymore. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
I don't want